Okay, are we ready? So there are copies of the Alice's paper of at least part of it, of the letter of Leibniz to Huygens. So everybody should have a copy. Plus the illustrations of the analysis sequence function that I go through and I used at the beginning of the class. I just want to start with Lin's emphasis in the last, in his last writing, in his last briefings, recommendations, in the intelligence talk, memos, and publications, particularly. Lin has been emphasizing again and again the crucial role of analysis situs as the form of geometry of non-entropy in the creative process of the human mind. Now, this is a difficult subject. I'm going to try to address this at the highest level possible, but at the same time in the simplest way possible, in introducing certain questions that are raised from the series of classes that we've done so far, six classes. This is the last class of the series, so I sort of going full circle, or shall I say, I'm going to go full torus. We'll do a little experiment to show you how this looks like. It looks a little bit silly, but I think you'll get the idea of going full torus. The insistence that Lin has been making are very, very important for world history, not just for learning something cute, nice, new, or something that we've been looking at sort of at the corner of our eye, but been scared of addressing, the question of Gauss, the question of Riemann. They're not easy to address, especially when they're treated with most of the books written on them are utterly, utterly disgusting in terms of replicating the Euler, Lagrange, Cauchy, you know, outlook that is being imposed on Gauss and Riemann. And of course, it doesn't work. And Lin is addressing this in a very crucial way, but he's addressing it not simply in terms of Gauss and Riemann, in terms of understanding these two, but in understanding ourselves, that this organization has reached a point in history where now it is time for people to make the kinds of breakthroughs that are necessary to bring the entirety of mankind into a higher manifold. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'd like to address the question of going from the Euclidean manifold to the Riemannian manifold exactly in that light. And I want to read Lin from this standpoint. This is a statement that Lin has made in the intelligence, in December 7th, intelligence, Liebig intelligence meeting at page 10. Anyone could read the following. He says, "So you get the true picture then, historically, had we not had the Enlightenment, had we not had this bunch of pederastic, sodomic parasites called Paolo Sarpi and his followers, including Euler and Lagrange, we would not have had any of this nonsense. But rather, we would have a civilization which was in the tradition of accepting what Leibniz called analysis situs, the scientific method of Cusa and Plato before him, the scientific method of Luca Pacioli, of Leonardo da Vinci, of Johannes Kepler, Leibniz, Gauss, Riemann, and so forth. We would never have had anything different. Everything that is different than what I say we must be having is lunacy and corruption. This lunacy and corruption accounts for, as I said before, everything that is taught in universities today, every subject, at least every formal subject. A subject like basket weaving doesn't count. To get a PhD in basket weaving doesn't count. Now, Lynn is addressing this in terms of the urgent need for the organization and members of the organization to begin really seriously addressing what this whole question of the Riemannian manifolds, or going from a lower manifold to a higher manifold, is all about. Now, every one of us here knows what this is because we're all organizers, and when you're an organizer, you go through that. And you go through that after a certain period of time, and you look back and you say, huh, wow, I made quite a pathway here from the beginning of my joining the organization and to this day. And you realize that you have progressed, that you've gone from a lower level of organizing your mind and understanding the world and understanding yourself and ideas, and you've developed into a higher ordering and understanding of the universe. So, it doesn't mean that it's all nice and good that we've succeeded in doing that after the first few months of organizing. No, it takes years. It takes years, and it takes a lot of fight. And I want to recall again the ideas of Carnot. There's no way that the fight for ideas is going to be any different than the war we're waging for the freedom of this nation and the freedom of the world than what, you know, Carnot did to free the nation of France to build an actual springboard for a government of the people, by the people, and for the people in Europe. And although he was not successful in doing it, the principles were absolutely the same as the principles that founded this America, this nation, and our forefathers. And in order to, I've been thinking again about this Carnot stuff, but relative to ideas. See, Carnot is very straightforward. He has a total commitment. There's no way that he can waver with his goal. He has a goal in mind. He knows what it is. It's clear in his mind. He has to succeed. He has to find the means, the ways, right? The direction, the purposefulness is there. The willfulness is there. And he has to accomplish the task. And the domain of ideas is the same thing, right? It's not academic. It's not a matter of, oh, well, if I don't know this now, I'll learn later, you know, when we do a little less mobilization. No, it is crucial for mankind. Mankind will not survive unless we solve the problem that Lynn identifies as the problem of measure. The problem of measuring, that simple problem, is all wrong. It's all screwed up, right? It's all sodomized from left and right, from the French to the British and so forth. I mean, it is total craziness to think that the form of measure is reduced to trying to take a little ruler and measure some lengths, right? This length, and that length, and this length, and this number of apples in the bushel, right? And this number of, you know, bouncing balls, you know, in the universe. That is not what counting is all about. And Lynn makes it very, very explicit. He refers, I'll refer to you again, Lynn's, one of his latest interventions, November 26, housing people in a post-industrial USA. Now, I don't know if people have read that, but it's very critical because what he does with market baskets is in an analysis thesis. And he says, this is the way it's going to be. This is how you do economics. Huh? And he's very upset because, you know, people have been, you know, missing the boat, missing the point, and again, they're falling into this Euler-Lagrange way of measuring. Hmm? And this is what he says in a footnote with respect to Riemann, which I'm going to address in some way this question tonight. He says, Riemann's fundamental discovery in physics, beginning with his 1854 habilitation dissertation, demolished for once and for all any allowable return to the neo-Newtonian delusions of Frederick II's Euler-Lagrange-Cohen, respecting both transcendental functions and a general theory of prime numbers. Once we apprehend the physical significance of a succession of Riemannian physical space-time manifold, we can no longer tolerate the delusion that transcendental functions are an expression of transcendental numbers. Also, the solution which Riemann derived from the so-called prime number domain for such a principle of manifold is not, as some moderns deluded themselves, an approximate solution for prime number determination. It is the only solution. Prime numbers do not exist as natural numbers of Kabbalist Leopold Kronecker Babylonian domain. They are defined in their very nature by the manifold with which they are subsumed. And this is why I use this construction here. You'll remember at the beginning of my class. This construction, which is nothing else but a biquadratic function using discoveries as opposed to numbers. But it's the same function. Look at what it looks like in terms of numbers. You'll remember we did go through rapidly the wave function that this represented by going 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 to 9 to 10 and so forth, 11, 12, 13 times, and then rotating again and again, and showing that each wave represents a certain aspect of determining prime numbers, which is exactly what Riemann and Gauss are addressing. I'm not going to go through the whole function again, but I just want to stress that the key problem in physics today is that still to this day, the way that Riemann and Gauss address the issue of prime numbers, not as actual counting numbers or actual lengths, but as actual actions, intervals of actions. All you have to do is replace in your mind the notion of an accounting amount of numbers that represent a certain, let's say, here's a line, and you divide this line in two, and then in two again, and then in two, and then in four, and so forth, and you measure this little distance, and you can always divide it more, and so forth. What are you doing? You're measuring lengths. That's wacko. It's useful, but it's wacko for what we want to do in terms of creativity and in terms of higher analysis synthesis problems in space-time. What has to be looked at is the directionality, the interval of action from this point to this point. And consider that this is what Analysis Citus is about. This is exactly what the very first problems that Leibniz raised is that question, that we don't treat numbers as magnitudes. Treat numbers as situations. Look at the geometry of situations, not the algebra of magnitudes. That's his first polemic. I'll quote you directly his, you know, the paper that you have in your hand. At the bottom of the very first page of the letter to Huygens, he addresses the question at the bottom and at the top of page 249. What does he say? He says, "But in spite of the progress which I have made in these matters, I am still not satisfied with algebra, because it does not give the shortest method or the most beautiful constructions in geometry. This is why I believe that so far as geometry is concerned, we need still another analysis which is distinctly geometrical or linear, and which will express situation, situs, directly, as algebra expresses magnitude directly." Now this is very, very exciting when you look at this, because you say, whoa, wait a minute. All is shaken up here. I mean, everything that I believed in is being questioned, is being put, you know, to the test. Gauss will pick this up. Gauss picks this up and addresses the very same questions. Gauss will go in some of his writings, and he says, about the geometrica situs that Leibniz had foreseen, and where only a few geometers have given it a mere glance, we know virtually nothing after 150 years. Now this is Gauss, you know. Right? This is 150 years ago. So 300 years, we don't know still to this day what analysis situs is all about after Leibniz, right? And then he writes, he says, there is a fundamental problem located at the limit of geometrica situs and geometrica magnitudinis. Right? Geometry of position, if you want, or location, and geometry of magnitude. This is what I'm talking about. Right? That's bring this question to the limit. You will find a paradox, a very interesting paradox that we'll go into, you know, in a minute. I really want to develop this idea further, is the question of space, of continuous space, because what prevents us from going and understanding what Gauss is talking about and what Leibniz is talking about and going to a Riemannian mode of thinking is this continuous space. Mm-hmm. The continuous space and the existence of things in and of themselves. That is, the existence of things independent of the space they lie in. And that is what Riemann will address in a very, very decisive way. Because we take it for granted that space is this sort of absolute vacuum somewhere, you know, absolute, you know, container in which you have things that exist. And it's very hard to get rid of that notion, because that's what your perception gives you all the time. Your perception is giving you bodies and things that exist in space. And that's the problem with the Euclidean space, particularly. Right? So what you want to look at is how to go beyond the manifold that is given to you by perception and go into a higher manifold. Right? Now, I don't mean by this that you have to go blind and, you know, punch your eyes and, you know, become, you know, a monk in the mountain and, you know, and only see with your inner eye, right? But there are things that are crucial to understand, and in the only way to understand them is by breaking with the perception pattern. So we've got to reflect on what our perception is telling us, you know, to see, and what is real, what it appears to be real. Right? I'll give you an example. Take the analysis situs example or case that Leibniz develops on the following page, page 252. Right? Page 252, look at figure 6. It's a very interesting little figure. Figure 6, and I'll just describe and read to you what he says. The second paragraph, which describes figure 6, where he says, let ABC be congruent to, that's the little sign there, that funny little circle on the hook on top of it, the thing. That is the sign that initially Leibniz had created for the purpose of determining what a congruence is. Today we will use three bars. Right? Something is equal to something, so if you say A is equal to B, you make two little bars, and if you say A is congruent to B mod, let's say 13 or C, which is what we did with the torus here, then you have a Gaussian kind of congruence, right? I'm not going to go into details of that. We can discuss that a little later in terms of how useful they are in the Riemannian geometry. But let me read. Let ABC be congruent to ABY. Okay, what does he have? He's got a little y in here also. That showed that y can go in a position in the same situation as c, right? And look what he says. That the locus of all y's will be circular. That is, given three points, A, B, C, to find a fourth point y, which has the same situation as C in relationship to AB. I assert that there is an infinity of points which satisfy this condition, and that the locus of all these points is a circle. This description of, or definition of a circular line does not, as does Euclid, presuppose a plane or even a straight line. Yet it is clear that the center of the circle is D between A and B. Huh? Now this is very interesting. He's already beyond Euclid here. Right? It's not Euclid. It's totally non-Euclidean here. Right? Not neo-Euclidean. No. You don't need a plane. You don't need a center. Huh? But how does he generate that? How is that generated? What is the simple analysis thesis of that? Yeah. Simple rotation. Right? This. All of it. And that creates a simply extended manifold. That circle and everything that pertains to the relationship of that circle, the geometry of the circle, in the plane or in three dimensions, can generate, for example, everything that the Euclidean plane has. Yet I did not generate it in a Euclidean way. I generated from a higher standpoint. Right? So Euclidean geometry, or simply extended geometry, comes from a higher geometry, a higher analysis thesis. The higher analysis thesis that permits me to do this. Right? And once I have that, and I do that, I can generate a circle. I can use the surface of the circle to generate polygons, lines, points, and I can generate out of these lines and these polygons and these points the Platonic solids, starting with the tetrahedron, which John built the other day when we drove down, to Washington together, right? Simply by simple circular action. You generate all these five Platonic solids, and you generate the entirety of the Euclidean plane, because that's what it is. Euclidean plane is, in fact, summed up in these five places. That's the Euclidean geometry. But we've generated it from a higher standpoint. Now, where does this come from? Where does it come from? I'm going to bring my little truck here to show you where it comes from. I need the citus.
Citus all down.
We're going to citus this whole thing. From a higher standpoint. Now, if this is a simple manifold, a simply extended manifold, right? Or a hypothesis, as Lynn would put it, right? It is a hypothesis that has definitions, that has assumptions, that has a whole series of theorems that all belong to the same inherited general series of axioms and postulates. And that kind of static space where things proceed are exist independent of space they're in. I mean, there's space here, but the space is not bothering this at all. I mean, you can have space, you can have time, you can have, all sorts of things separated from one another, right? Euclidean space is purely abstract space, right? It's not the real physical space in which we live. It's the space we see, perceive, but it's not the true space that we want to look at. So where does this come from? Well, where does a single or simply extended manifold come from? Let's ask the question in Riemannian terms. It comes from a Riemannian manifold. It comes from a multiply connected or multiply extended manifold. Now think of the manifold as being simply composed of different forms of circular action that are different and independent of one another. See, if I go like this, I generate a simply extended manifold. But if I add a dimension, if I add another direction, what happens?
Layton's donut.
And this is Layton's donut.
Not really.
No.
For the mind, Layton.
It's the donut. It's the donut in your mind. Right? It's the idea. It's the idea of the donut.
Oh, now Nicholas wants to.
He heard the word donut.
Donut to me, I'm sure.
So you see, what I've done is I went from a Euclidean manifold to a Riemannian manifold. That's all I did. This is a Euclidean manifold. And this is a Riemannian manifold. Right? Now, where does that Riemannian manifold come from? Where does that donut come from? Well, imagine that my chair is being pulled. Right? You want to try this?
Yeah.
And? We need someone that's small and
compact
in the chair.
What?
More easily mobile.
Okay.
You are very trusting or very foolish.
So one.
You're gonna spin her, yeah.
Okay. Two.
You gotta spin it.
And three.
Hard.
Yeah. Whoa, 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 whoa. You get the idea.
Dunkin' Donuts delivers.
Yeah,
the hand's gonna walk. Greater, I had positive.
Even greater donuts.
So what do we have? We have a triply extended circular action, a triply extended manifold. You need to read your Riemann. This is the text that Lynn keeps referring to again and again and again and again for the last 30 years. And I know he still has a few good years to go, and he's going to repeat it again and again and again until people get a sense of what is implied in this. Riemann on page 413 and 414 says, in a concept whose various modes of determination form a continuous manifold, if one passes in a definite way from one mode of determination to another, the modes of determination which are traversed constitute a simply extended manifold. And its essential mark is this, that it is a continuous progress, that its continuous progress is possible from any point only in two directions, forward or backward. Like this or like this. We couldn't do it in any other way. This thing goes one way, clockwise, or the other way, counterclockwise. Either you go in that direction or you go in the other direction.
You back up.
Right? Forward or backward. If now one forms the thought of this manifold again passing over into another entirely different, in other words, which is not a circle, which is a torus, which is this thing, right? And you have here A and B and C and Y, and this is going all around, right? You have a totally, every point that is in such a, let me backtrack. It now forms one, if one forms the thought of this manifold, again, passing over into another entirely different, here again, in a definite way, that is, in such a way that every point goes over into a definite point of the other, then will all the modes of determination thus obtained form a doubly extended manifold. In similar procedure, one obtains a triply extended manifold when one represents to oneself that a double extension passes over into, in a definite way, into one entirely different, and it is easy to see how one can prolong this construction indefinitely. If one considers his object of thought as variable, instead of regarding the concept as determinable, right? The object in itself, or something that changes, variable, right? Then this construction can be characterized as a synthesis of the variability of n plus 1 dimensions. Out of a variability of n dimensions and a variability of 1 dimension. Right? In other words, we started with 1, with 2, and go into 3. And this is just one type of a Riemannian kind of construction. This is not the end all and be all of it. This is just a simple illustration to show how the mind, in a natural way, is able to change the entire series of axioms and postulates of a given theorem lattice and go into a higher one. And that's the purpose of this organization, is to be able to locate in our own minds the ability to go from a lower manifold to a higher manifold. And then a multiply connected manifold. That's what this whole question of biquadratic residues is all about. This is what Riemann picks up in Gauss. Says, aha, I'm able now to construct something that will give me a new way of understanding the metric or the measure, the measurement, right, of change. See, what he's measuring, see, this is very crucial here. He's not measuring lengths. He's measuring change. Right? That's what measurement is about. It's to measure the transformation into a higher order. Now, think of the simple conception of what can prevent in a Euclidean plane someone from understanding fully, internalizing what the significance of the change is here, to go from this lower manifold to a higher manifold. What is it in Euclidean space that prevents people from accessing higher ideas? Think of the idea of lines, points, or as Riemann would say, bodies even, which exist independently of space. In other words, independent of position, independent of situations. Everything that you perceive, you're convinced, your perception is convinced that all that you perceive has existence in and of itself, independent of space that it lies in. And that's the problem. There's no reason, no sufficient reason at all, that bodies or lines or things should exist independent of the space that they occupy. That's a real problem. Think of it. How can you think of an object? For example, the object fire, or the object water, or the object earth. Huh? Let's see what Plato has to say about this. People should read the Timaeus when they get a chance, because Plato raises the whole issue of analysis citrus right there in the Timaeus. Right? And here's what he says about the analysis citrus of change. He says, in the first place, we see that what we just now called water, by condensation, I suppose becomes stone and earth. And this same element, when melted and dispersed, passes into vapor and air. Air again, when inflamed, becomes fire. And again, fire, when condensed and extinguished, passes once more into the form of air. And once more, air, when collected and condensed, produces cloud and mist. And from these, when still more compressed, comes flowing waters. And from water comes earth and stone. And once more, and thus generations appears to be transmitted from one to the other in a circle. Thus then, as the several elements never present themselves in the same form, how can anyone have the assurance to assert positively that any of them, whatever it may be, is one thing rather than another? It's enough to be confused, huh? No one can. But much the safest plan is to speak of them as follows. Anything which we see to be continually changing. As for example, fire. We must not call this or that, but rather say that it is of such a nature, nor let us speak of water as this, but always as such. Nor must we imply that there is any stability in any of those things which we indicate by the use of the words this or that, supposing ourselves to signify something thereby, for they are too volatile to be detained in any such expressions as this or that, or relative to this, or any other mode of speaking which represents them as permanent. We ought not to apply this to any of them, but rather the word such, which expresses the similar principle circulating in each and all of them. For example, that should be called fire, which is such as nature always, and so of everything that has generation, that in which the elements severely grow up and appear and decay, is also to be called by the name this or that, but that which is of a certain nature, hot or white, or anything which admits of opposite quality, are all things that are compounded of them, ought not to be so denominated. And listen to what he says in letter 7. This is the letter where It's one of the most beautiful pieces that Plato's ever written. It's a letter to Dennis, to Dionysius, who's a tyrant of Syracuse. And he's organizing the tyrant of Syracuse to create the First Republic. He's establishing with Dennis, before he gets sold as a slave, and he doesn't succeed in creating the Republic, but that's his goal. It's a very important political task that to establish the city of Syracuse in Sicily as the first Platonic Republic. And here's what he says about analysis cetus. Hence, no intelligent man will ever be so bold as to put into language those things which his reason has contemplated, especially not into a form that is unalterable, which must be the case, which what is expressed in written symbols. And he goes into a very extended discussion of how you need at least five different levels, right? The names, the description, the bodily form, the conception, and what reason sees, right, as the actual final cause of this whole process. This is what Riemann is putting into advanced mathematics. Now, the problem of magnitude and location is not solved by simply saying, okay, well, we're not going to treat objects as things in themselves. You end up, you know, in a sort of mush, right? In some kind of a soup, right? Prime, you know, primitive soup where everything is undifferentiated. You have to differentiate. How do you do it? How do you differentiate? Riemann addresses the question in the following way. He says, the conditions for lines to be independent of position in space. In the first place, can be expressed thus. That the measure of the curvature in every point is equal to zero in three directions of surface. People see what he just said? What's three directions of surface?
Up, down.
That's right. Up, down, sideways, forward and backward. It's the Cartesian grid, right? This kind of thing, right? In that direction, right? Or if you want to have portrayed, you know, in a cube, it would look like this. Right? This direction, that direction, right? Going back, and this direction going sideways. So up, forward, backward, you know, and sideways. Three directions. That's what he's talking about. This is the measure of curvature in every point would be equal to zero in all three directions. In other words, you have zero curvature. That's the Euclidean plane. What's that?
This is Cartesian.
Yeah. It's Cartesian, it's Euler, it's Lagrange, it's Maupertuis, it's all of these characters who cannot get away from their perception. Right? It's essentially a perception lattice. And they cannot break with it. In the second place, says Riemann, if one assumes, let me finish the first, I'm sorry. And therefore the metric relations of the space are determined when the sum of the angles of a triangle is everywhere equal to two right angles. Huh? And we know that that has to be the case for a plane, because otherwise if we have a surface of positive curvature, which is the sphere, and have a triangle on that sphere, that triangle will have angles that are greater than two right angles. And a space of negative curvature will have similarly a triangle whose angles are going to be less than the sum of two right angles. Not going to go through the details of that. I mean, people can see that. But that's what he's referring. So he's addressing what Lin addresses as the Pythagorean, right? This is the quasi-Pythagorean, you know, because you don't have a universe that is continuously flat. It doesn't exist, right? But that's where the quasi, you know, the Pythagorean applies. But everywhere else, it will apply in the infinitely small or infinitely large in a quasi-form. Mm-hmm. Now, in the second place, if one assumes at the start, like Euclid, an existence independent of situation, that's his words, existence independent of situation. That's Euclid. That's our perception, our daily perceived things in themselves. The thing in and of itself. This is an object that is independent of the space that it's in. Right? You can't say that that can't be true. It is true. Right? You can see it. You can feel it. You can smell it.
If you take the cap off.
You can taste it. That's Euclid. An existence independent of situation. Not only for lines, he says, but also for bodies. Then it follows that the measure of curvature is everywhere constant. Now that is very heavy stuff. In the second place, if one assumes at the start, like Euclid, an existence independent of situation, not only for lines, but also for bodies, then it follows that the measure of curvature is everywhere constant. And then the sum of the angles in all triangles is determined as soon as it is fixed for one triangle.
What do you mean? No change.
No change. Same everywhere. Constant.
Right up here.
Yes.
He could be saying that it could be constantly positively curved or negatively curved as well, doesn't he?
Because this is where things are going to change. Right? Because as soon as you introduce a change in the curvature, this is Euclidean. This is the flat plane, right? He says, like Euclid. Right? Second place, we assume at the start, like Euclid, an existence independent of situation.
Yeah, but I'm just asking, you can, if you have a constantly positively curved space, of a spherical curvature, that's constantly curved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Why are you saying that that is not included in what he said down there? I don't understand.
He said like Euclid.
But he's saying he's talking about constant curvature.
Zero curvature. Constant zero curvature.
He's talking about zero curvature.
He said that it could be the thing.
Okay.
He said that.
Young naive imagination.
All right. Well, I'm missing. I just taking the two things out of context.
So, you have zero curvature. In the third place, and here I suspect, and I have to make a correction in the English text, you should verify on the German original text, there's a mistake that's made. He says, in the third place, finally, instead of assuming the length of lines to be independent of place and direction, one might even assume their length and direction to be dependent of place. Upon this understanding, the changes in place or differences in positions are complex quantities expressible in three independent units. Now he's talking about the Gaussian difference, real numbers, imaginary numbers, and so forth, which I won't wander into. But I will emphasize this. It says, in the third place, instead of assuming the length of lines to be independent of space, length of lines, independent of space and direction, one might even assume their length and direction to be dependent on place. Now the text here says independent, which makes it absurd, right? Because he repeats, you know, if it's not this, it's this. Now if it's not independent, it's independent. Doesn't make any sense, right? So either it's independent on one side and it's dependent on the other side. So one might even assume their length and direction to be dependent on place, dependent on position. And that is the crux of the transformation of things in itself to intervals of action. This is what we have in music. That's why Lynn keeps insisting again and again and again. Between the notes. The music is in between the notes. The music is not in the notes. It's not in the things in themselves. It's not in the metric, right? The worst thing that was ever invented in music was a metronome. Right? Crazy, right? Right? The metric. This is a Cartesian, you know, torture, you know, for children that have to learn music. Horrible. But it's the same thing. You carry over into music, or you carry over into other, you know, areas of knowledge, the same axiomatic problems of Euler, Cauchy, Descartes, and so forth. I'm not going to say Euclid, because Euclid was better than that. See, I'm convinced that Euclid had an analysis situs of his own construction that was reduced eventually, you know, to this sort of, you know, Aristotelian hodgepodge, which we call the 13 books, right? 13 books which end with the Platonic Solids. No, the whole thing should have started, and in fact, lawfully, should begin with the 5 Platonic Solids. Right? The whole QED operation, right? Quodiat demonstrandum, to do the proof. Right? The proofs, the Euclidean proofs. The proofs are in the constructions, the analysis situs constructions. They're not in the metrics. They're not in the lengths.